Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. The Thai Navy says at least four boys among a group of 12 and their soccer coach have been rescued from a cave where they had been trapped for over 2 weeks. The four boys rescued Sunday have been taken to a hospital. The 13 people disappeared after venturing into the cave June 23rd. Rains from the moon, monsoon season, and diminishing oxygen level threatened their safety. One diver died Thursday during the rescue effort since it began. In the days since they were found in the cave, the kids have written notes to their families expressing optimism and encouraging them not to worry. The 25-year-old soccer coach has written as well, thanking people for support and apologizing to the parents of the boys. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo ended 2 days of meetings in North Korea trying to come up with a denuclearization plan from Pyongyang. From Pyongyang, Secretary Pompeo went on to Tokyo to meet with his Japanese and South Korean counterparts, where he said sanctions on North Korea will remain for now. He downplayed North Korea's accusation that the U.S. had made gangster-like demands that abandon its nuclear program and that their talks were regrettable.
Look, people are going to make stray comments after meetings. If I paid attention to what the press said, I'd go nuts, and I refuse to do that. I am determined to achieve the commitment that President Trump made, and I am counting on Chairman Kim to be determined to follow through on the commitment that he made.
Pyongyang said the outcome of the talks was very concerning. Officials in Afghanistan confirmed Sunday the Taliban rocketed a high-profile emergency security meeting in the troubled southeastern Ghazni province that wounded at least two soldiers and several civilians in the process. Taliban fighters fired several rockets. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump's attorney said Sunday that the president's legal team is close to determining that he will not sit for an interview with special counsel Robert Mueller in his investigation of Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential campaign. Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor and Trump's lead attorney, told ABC News and CNN that Trump's lawyers want evidence from Mueller's investigators that Trump engaged in wrongdoing before agreeing to let him be questioned. Giuliani told ABC that we've been through everything on collusion and obstruction. We can't find any incriminating anything, and we need a basis for this investigation. Mueller has been investigating Russian links to the Trump campaign and whether the president obstructed justice by firing James Comey, the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who was heading the agency's Russia probe. President Trump will on Monday announce his nominee for Supreme Court to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. The announcement is likely to set off a major confirmation battle in the Senate, where Republicans hold a narrow majority and opposition Democrats say they are ready for a fight over Trump's court pick. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal is one of them.
The Republicans control the votes in the Senate, but we have the American people on our side. The vast majority of American people, shown by poll after poll, want Roe v. Wade to be preserved.
He spoke on ABC's This Week, as did President Trump's Supreme Court advisor, Leonard Leo. He dismisses the argument that Trump should not appoint a justice who could be hearing arguments in the Russian meddling investigation.
I think that's a red herring. There are always issues that an executive branch and president deal with on a regular basis that are extraordinarily important and controversial, and we don't hold up Supreme Court nominations or confirmations for those.
Legal analysts noted that Kennedy's departure leaves a critical void on the high court. He was often a member of 5-4 majority decisions on the high court, and now conservatives see a chance to solidify their majority on the Supreme Court for years to come. Haiti's government suspended sharp fuel price increases after widespread violence broke out in the capital and elsewhere. News reports said that there was at least one death in the 2 days of protest. The proposal followed an agreement with the International Monetary Fund to stop subsidizing energy prices so more of the budget could be put toward social services and improved infrastructure. The leaders of Eritrea and Ethiopia embraced at Asmara International Airport Sunday. It's a historic moment in what has long been one of Africa's most entrenched conflicts. The meeting between the two continues a thawing of relations between the countries. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Minister announced that the government will fully abide by the Algiers agreement. So I think there have been a series of bold initiatives on both sides.
Eritrean President Isaias Afewerki meets with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Sunday.
This is a question of access to national resources and a mismanaged succession plan. We have got competing actors surrounding the president trying to decide who should become the next president.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika removes the vice president as head of the Ministry of Disaster Management Affairs.
Social security is the financial heartbeat, is the heartbeat of the Gambia, because social security is things that are into every pie in the Gambia's economy. If you stop that office working for 2 days, in monetary-wise, you're losing between $1 and $2 million a day.
And the Gambian social security workers embark on a sit-down strike. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. He is the executive director at the Washington, D.C.-based think tank, the Nigerian American Leadership Council, or NALC, who has declared his candidacy to contest in the Nigerian presidential election scheduled for next year. Sam Oki Mbonu says the world has watched the West African country descend into strife and chaos on international television. He blames the country's economic and security challenges on a leadership vacuum. Mbonu, who seeks to challenge incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari in next year's election, joins us live here in the VOA studios. Good afternoon, Sam.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Peter.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So tell me, why are you running to become the next president of Nigeria?
Thank you, Peter. Well, that question has been answered by numerous press appearances, but I am running because I am the most uniquely qualified candidate in this upcoming elections, 2019. I bring a substantial background in 21st century governance, having served as in a politically appointed role in the United States as a commissioner in the region where I lived, in Maryland. And also my professional training in Washington in law, I have a JD in law, has also given me a different level of preparation. But beyond that, I was also a founder of one of the most influential think tanks in Washington and in the United States, which helped to provide policy guidance on Nigeria and sub-Saharan Africa among the United States policymakers.
I'm aware, and I'm sure you are too, that the quest of becoming Nigeria's president or the president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria requires a lot of financial support. How are you going to do this, looking at the fact that both the ruling APC and the PDP would have the financial muscle to potentially crush you if you are not able to challenge them financially? How would you do this?
Yeah. We have looked at all of the models for this race, and we are not intimidated by either the APC or the PDP or the old status quo political machine, because what we are running is a global campaign for the heart and soul of Nigeria. We have Nigerians that live in every corner of the world who are already involved in this race, from the diaspora, from the United States, from EU, from Asia, from other places in Africa. Everybody has taken stake and continues to take stake in this campaign. You got to remember that the diaspora is the one community outside of Nigeria that has consistently put $21 billion into Nigeria every year to help augment the local economies and everything else in between. And if the election is going to cost $100, $200 million, $500 million, that is not an intimidating number, especially for someone like myself with my global presence. I'm a global citizen with profound qualifications to run and win the presidency of Nigeria. So we're not intimidated by the cash flow. People are going to stake in this campaign from everywhere in the world, both inside of Nigeria and Nigerians that also live in other places who are participating in this campaign.
Now, the government has said that corruption has been brought to the barest minimum and that the significant threat posed by Boko Haram has been sharply reduced. How do you go against the president with such successes as the government claims?
Well, you know, we have a saying in law for legal professionals that says the thing speaks for itself or the facts speak for themselves. Now, what we have in the northeast of Nigeria doesn't really show the level of containment that we expected from this government. But beyond that, the rest of Nigeria, the rest of North Central Nigeria has spiraled into profound, uncontrollable violence under this government. Any situation that gives rise to insecurity at that level is certainly being watched by the rest of the world, and there's a consensus around the world, whether it's in Abuja or Washington, D.C., or in London or in Beijing, that this government is demonstrating alarming failure as far as the security of Nigeria. And so this government cannot afford to continue, because if they continue along this level, the rest of Nigeria will be decimated in no time.
If Nigerians give you the mandate to become their next president, what will you do in your first 100 days?
My first 100 days will be dedicated to containing the security situation in Nigeria. We have consulted with experts from around the world as far as security, and the situation in Nigeria can be contained in between 45 and 60 days as far as the security situation. I am going to be the kind of president that takes charge and takes responsibility. I am not going to run around blaming Libya, blaming non-existent, faceless people. I am going to take control, and if I fail, the failure will be my responsibility. But I am 100% sure that I will contain the security situation in Nigeria. I have the capacity to do that.
There have been concerns about issues of religion and ethnicity in Nigeria. How would you resolve this? Because there appear to be some tension, although the political class dismisses it. Analysts are saying the political class, use this as a stick, as well as a campaign tool to attain power. How will you resolve some of these concerns?
Yeah, well, the ethnic situation for the new generation is actually beginning to dissipate, because people's concern right now are more with the welfare and the security of their persons and their families beyond where they are from. Now, in the past, the status quo have frequently tried to play one ethnic group against the other, or one religion against the other. But the issues that are alive today are such that those issues supersede where you're from. You have to be secure in your person to begin to think beyond that. The first principle of humanity is the principle of defending yourself against adversity, whether it's a weather-related adversity or man-made adversity. What is happening in Nigeria as far as the religious and ethnic undertones are situations that we have had a comprehensive look at and know that we can contend them. Now, as far as religion proper, what is also the reality is that Nigeria is not as split between Muslims and Christians as sometimes they appear. Because even in regions in Nigeria where there appear to be large Muslim populations, like in the north or in the north central, there are also Christian populations even in those places. And so if the election is going to be based on religious lines, which I know is not going to be, then my campaign, based on the research and all the surveys we have done on the ground, has made inroads in every corner of Nigeria, from the northeast to the north central, especially the north central, to the northwest, to the southwest, to the southeast, and to the south south. I am a global citizen. And when I come into Nigeria, I don't look at people with ethnic labels or with religious labels.
We would have to continue this on another day. Mm-hmm. Samoki Mbonu seeks to challenge President Muhammadu Buhari in the Nigerian presidential election. He joined us live from here in Washington, D.C. Eritrean Information Minister says the embrace of President Isaias Afewerki and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in the capital Asmara is historic. His remark came after the Eritrean President welcomed the Ethiopian Prime Minister at the Asmara International Airport Sunday. The meeting is the first between leaders of the two neighboring countries since 2000, when President Afewerki and former Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi signed the Algiers Agreement. For more about the meeting between leaders of the two countries, I reach Eritrean Information Minister Yemani Gebremeskel.
Yes, the Prime Minister and his delegation arrived at 9 o'clock Asmara time this morning. You can see from the jubilation of people in the streets, the intensity of emotions, that this is a really historic moment. Also because this is happening after 20 years. We've not had summits between heads of state of the two countries. We've not had visits of this kind since 1998. That's a long time. Of course, the two countries were at war. Now, I think the positive winds of peace are blowing. There are high expectations in both countries for a lasting, enduring peace based on each other's respect of sovereignty and territorial integrity.
This is seen by a lot of people as a major step into normalizing relations between Asmara and Addis Ababa. What is your take on that?
Look, the problem, the prevalent problem, has been resolved a long time ago through a normal process of law. So there is no real barrier. If there is political goodwill, there is no real barrier to impede or to prevent normalization between these two countries.
I understand the two leaders are supposed to be having a series of meetings alongside the delegation. What can you tell me about this?
No, the meetings have barely begun. We'll have news in due time.
So how are the people of Eritrea reacting to this visit, if I may ask you?
I think you'll have to look at some of the footage of the local, the whole event has been broadcast by the local TV station, of course, Ethiopian TV station, and some foreign news agents. I think you'll have to see that to really gauge the intensity of the emotions, the happiness, the jubilation.
So what are the expectations of Eritreans?
I don't talk about expectations. I think at the end of the day, we are neighbors, we have destiny together, we have cultural the affiliations. So once the problems are resolved, I think once legality is there, as I said earlier, there is no barrier.
What is the government's message to the people of Eritrea as the two leaders met, shook hands, and President Afewerki welcomed the Prime Minister of Ethiopia to Asmara today?
There is a long. I think we have seen a sense of watershed events in the past few weeks. The Ethiopian Prime Minister announced that the government will fully abide by the Algiers agreement. So I think there have been a sense of bold initiatives on both sides.
Okay. Yemani Gebremeskel is the Eritrean Information Minister. He spoke with me from Asmara. Malawian President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika says Vice President Saulos Chilima will no longer be in charge of the Ministry of Disaster Management Affairs. This followed a fallout with the Vice President over allegations of corruption. Vice President Chilima recently stated that corruption in the administration has risen to embarrassing levels. He has since declared his plans to challenge the president in next year's elections. For more regarding the fallout between the president and the vice president, I read Vincent Kondwi, a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
I think to begin with, that is long overdue. It was a logical and expected process that the president was supposed to undertake way back. So it does not come as a surprise, and it is a climax of the determination of the political events that have been happening over the past few months. So this is the final stage where we see the president and his vice president having a political show that everyone can be able to see now.
Now, so what is next? Now that the vice president has announced that he will be challenging President Arthur Peter Mutharika in next year's general election?
Well, I think in terms of approach and application of strategy, I think the incumbent vice president has gotten it wrong. The thing is that if he knew very well that he would challenge the incumbency, he had had a very big opportunity where he was supposed to explain to the people of Malawi that he wants to stand for the presidency. Now, he has been delaying, and all the momentum which was there for him is slowly but vanishing right in his face. So, well, he has got the choice to either stand and protect his political career or not stand at all and just pave way for the established political structures that we have in terms of the opposition Malawi Congress Party and the DPP.
Some people are suggesting that his revelations and accusations of graft, which he said has reached embarrassing level, could be a moral blow that will undermine the integrity of the president in next year's election. Do you think such blows could be fatal to allow other opposition parties, like the biggest opposition party, MCP, or perhaps Joyce Banda, to win the presidency next year?
Malawi is generally a docile country. It's no active citizenship per se. So you wouldn't expect a lot of reaction from the population at large. Because ordinarily, what has happened is a scandal of very significant proportions, to the extent that there could have been a large-scale protest or large-scale reaction from the population. But so far, everything is just going on normal, as if nothing serious has happened. So to me, the impact that the incumbent may face is not quite a straightforward issue. And when you look at the voting behavior over the last three elections, it's ethnic-based, it's regional-based. People give their loyalty to the political candidates not based on policy issues, but strictly speaking based on the regional blocks where those leaders come from. So on its own, it is not an issue that could affect the voting patterns in 2019.
This is not the first time a vice president in Malawi has fallen out with the president. It happened with Dr. Joyce Banda, it happened with Kassim Chilumba, and now this. Why is this so much of a problem that a vice president of a government happens to always fall out with the president? Why?
It's a lack of succession plan that is mismanaged. It looks always like the president has his own, he's surrounded by people who want to have a say or influence on who becomes the next head of state. So the question that comes to play is whether the succession plan that the president has and the succession plans of those around him do not have a congruency in terms of who should succeed the president and who should have the access to national resources. Bear in mind that within the Malawian context, the head of state controls a lot of the patronage machinery. So this lack of a succession plan and who gets to the presidency is a question of who the people surrounding the president want to be the next president. So seriously speaking, this is a question of access to national resources and a mismanaged succession plan where we have competing actors surrounding the president trying to decide who should become the next president.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The Gambian social security workers have embarked on a sit-down strike. The move follows the government's refusal to accommodate their request for the managing director of the government parastatal to be fired amid allegations of corruption and abuse of office. For VOA, Panderi Mbai has more from North Carolina.
Over 200 staffers of Gambia Social Security, Housing and Finance Corporation are taking part in the strike action. Mamadou Camara is the staff representative at the parastatal.
The strike action is all about a petition that the staff of Social Security and Housing Finance Corporation wrote to the Secretary General and Head of the Civil Service Office of the President due to the fact that over 1 year, Social Security's management didn't have a board of directors. So we wrote a petition, 21-page petition, and in this petition embedded allegations of corruption, allegations of nepotism, allegations of abuse of office done by the ranging managing director currently, Mr. Mangan.
A new board chairman was appointed by the president this past week to help resolve the mounting dispute between the social security workers and their managing director. A board meeting was convened in which Camara attended. He says that he was ejected from the gathering because the workers' complaints against Mangiang were not part of the agenda.
The staff in unison, in a general meeting organized by the staff on Thursday, argued that from immediate effect, we're going on a sit-down strike for the government to act, because in that board meeting, the managing director told me he is not an employee of the staff, but by the president. So it's only the president who can sack. So at the moment, we did not work on Thursday, we did not work today, and then the impasse persists.
The striking social security workers recently marched to the state house in Banjul, where they vented their anger and frustrations against their boss, Mangiang. They were reassured by the Secretary General and Head of the Civil Service that the matter would be investigated.
The demands are very simple. Mangiang must go. The managing director must go because he has stolen money, paddy money, and the proofs are there. And in our service rule, if you steal a dime, if you steal one bottle, you should summarily be dismissed. So this guy was taking 7 days paddy money and wasted air ticket money, and in that process, employed a girl, and within 6 months, confirmed the girl, promoted her, transferred her, and paid 3 million for her to pursue an ACCA professional course in Ghana, when there are people who have served 20 years and they are on the queue.
Mangiang has denied the staffers' allegations. He told a local Gambian online television site, the Fatu Network, that there are only 2 trained accountants, including himself at the Social Security Corporation. And he says by sending the lady to pursue professional accounting course in Ghana will benefit the company in the long term. Staff spokesperson Camara describes to what extent the strike has affected Gambian pensioners.
Social Security is the financial heartbeat, is the heartbeat of the Gambia, because Social Security fingers are into every pie in the Gambia's economy. If you stop that office working for 2 days, in monetary wise, you're losing between $1 and $2 million a day. Not to talk about the pensioners that are going to go on treatment. Not to talk about the claims that are lying for pensioners to go on hajj. The claims that are lying for pensioners to put their roofs in order before the rains come. Nobody can quantify the damage it will do to Gambia and the Gambian economy.
Social Security's managing director, Mohamed Mangiang, is a former banker. He once headed the Standard Chartered Bank Kenya branch. Mangiang has also denied staffers' allegations of alleged financial impropriety.
As to being selfish and greedy, I don't know what they mean. If I was greedy, I would. Since the beginning of this year, for example, I have never traveled, not because there wasn't traveling opportunities, but I felt every single opportunity did not add any value to Social Security. I turned them down. Now, if I was greedy, I probably would have traveled to put the per diems in my pocket, but I didn't because they were of no value to me.
Mangiang urged staffers to be ready to adapt to change. He says the old ways of running the institution are now a thing of the past. He says the parastatal is spending huge amount of money on staffers, including loans made to them, which have not been repaid. He says because of such financial indiscipline, there was not enough money to give pensioners a salary increase. Mangiang says this is at the root of the staff dissatisfaction with him and his policies. A presidential spokesperson says charges against him are being investigated. Meanwhile, the staffers say without his removal, they will continue their strike. For VOA Africa, this is Pandey Mbaye reporting.
The head of the UN Migration Agency, William Lacey Swing, is appealing to Libyan authorities to stop detaining migrants intercepted or rescued at sea by the Coast Guard after trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration praises Libya's dramatically stepped up anti-smuggler operations. With European Union support, it notes the number of migrants rescued in Libya's territorial waters and brought back to shore has greatly increased. IOM spokesman Leonard Doyle says in the past month alone, the Libyan Coast Guard has intercepted nearly 4,000 migrants.
Despite occasional, from what we understand, rogue issues. There generally seems to be a desire by the Coast Guard personnel to save lives, to get their country back on a regular footing, and to avoid having kind of indiscriminate irregular migration where the only people profiting are the smugglers.
IOM Chief Swing recently returned from a two-day visit to Libya, where he appealed to the authorities to end the cruel policy of locking up migrants who already have suffered so much trying to reach European shores. Doyle says there are some signs the authorities are willing to consider this.
They'll probably do it by trying to speed up their repatriation. So we support them in voluntary repatriation, voluntary return, humanitarian return from Libya. Sometimes takes a while because they don't have papers, they don't have documents. The only embassies in the country really full-time are African embassies, and even they are at very low capacity.
Doyle says once the documentation and bureaucratic process is completed, it will be relatively simple to repatriate the migrants. He says IOM has a charter flight leaving for an African destination practically every day, taking people who voluntarily want to return home. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. World Cup Russia 2018 concludes in just a week with the final on Sunday, and it seems to be a European affair. Belgium play France in the semi-final on Tuesday, with the other semi-final scheduled for Wednesday. All five African nations, Senegal, Nigeria, Egypt, Morocco, and Tunisia, crashed out in the first stage of the World Cup, but it's not all over for African fans. For instance, France has 14 players in the squad who would be able to play for an African country. Indeed, two French players have siblings who do exactly that. Paul Pogba's brother, Florentin, plays for Guinea, while Steve Mandanda's brother plays for the DR Congo. Both previously played for France in national youth teams before opting to represent countries where their parents came from. Belgium, meanwhile, has 8 players of African parentage, with either one or both parents hailing from the continent. According to FIFA rules, footballers who have played a competitive international for one team cannot switch to another side. But this rule has been relaxed to allow footballers to change nationality from junior to senior level. Meanwhile, Tunisia says it's open to bid for the 2030 World Cup with Algeria and Morocco. The 2026 World Cup will be the first to be held in three nations when the US, Mexico, and Canada host the tournament. Algeria's sports minister is reported to have said that his country is to study whether such a bid is feasible. The president of the Tunisia Football Federation, Wadi Jari, said Tunisia would also like to see it happen. Officials in Morocco, who have already declared the intention to bid, are yet to respond to the idea. Morocco last month lost out to a joint North American bid in the vote for the 2026 finals and immediately signaled its intention to try again. It would be a sixth bid for Moroccans after 5 previous failures. An application for the Maghreb with Morocco, Algeria and Tunisia would indeed be a strong bid. Argentina, Uruguay and Paraguay last year launched a three-nation South American bid to host the 2030 tournament, seeking to mark the centenary of the first World Cup hosted by Uruguay in 1930. Morocco and Tunisia played at the World Cup in Russia but were eliminated at the group stage, while Algeria reached the second round in Brazil 4 years ago. A FIFA vote to decide the 2030 host is not expected before 2022, when the World Cup is headed to Qatar. Still in football, Egyptian club Al Ismaili have re-signed Egypt's record-breaking goalkeeper, Essam El Hadary, on a free transfer. the 45-year-old veteran goalkeeper and his place in history during Egypt's 2-1 loss to Saudi Arabia, where he became the oldest man to play at a World Cup. El Hadary ends his contract with the Saudi club Al Tawun FC, where he was the first foreign goalkeeper to play in Saudi Arabia. This will be El Hadary's third stint at Ismaili, where he first played in 2009 for a year before joining Zamalek and returned in 2014 before heading to Wadi Degla. And in tennis, Rafael Nadal will now keep hold of the world number one ranking after beating Alex de Minaur to reach the Wimbledon fourth round. The Spaniard comfortably overcame the Australian teenager 6-1, 6-2, 6-4 on centre court. The 17-time Grand Slam champion needed to reach the last 16 to stay on top when the next rankings are released on July 16th. Nadal, seeded second behind 8-time Wimbledon champion Roger Federer, was in command from the start against the 19-year-old debutant, the youngest player left in the draw. Meanwhile, top seed Simona Halep went out of Wimbledon in the third round after losing an epic three-set battle against Haisi Suwi. The Taiwanese world number 48 serve was broken 7 times and she saved a match point before winning 3-6, 6-4, 7-5 in 2 hours and 20 minutes. It now means Czech 7th seed Karolina Pliskova is the only top 10 player remaining in the women's singles draw. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Yeah, yeah. Let me hear you sing. Yeah, yeah. Sass on the beat. Yeah, girl. Them know about me yesterday. Every girl you was designer. Them know about me yesterday. I know say your love will cost you something. Now you they do me something, something. You they do me like you gonna. I see the fire in your eyes. Burning like a cigarette. Baby girl, are you from Ghana? Or you coming from Somalia? Are you coming from Uganda? Or you coming from Nigeria? African bag, baby, don't change your style. Girl, I love you the way you are. The way you are. Feeling your dancing, girl. Stars on the beat. Baby girl, you're from Angola. Sister from South Africa. Pretty girl, I wanna hold ya. Talk to my ladies in a dream. African bad girl. Baby, don't change your style. Girl, I love you the way you are. The way you are. Feeling your dancing, girl. Stars on the beat. Make you dance. Say if you like Konto, make you dance. Say if you like this or if you like that. Say if you like bounce, make you bounce. Say if you like Galala, make you dance. Say if you like Konto, make you dance. Say if you like this or if you like that. Say if you like bounce, make you bounce. I love the things you do to me. I feel alright. I love the feeling that I feel. I'm feeling nice. I love the things you do to me. I feel alright. I'ma get Joe for me. With your sexy body. With your sexy body. Baby girl, please. Baby girl, Joe for me. I'ma get Joe for me. With your sexy body. With your sexy body. African bag. Baby, don't change your style. Girl, I love you the way you are. The way you are. Feeling your dancing, girl.
on the beat.
You're not.
Shinga kwa gana mavumba, mkwanja manoti, ni kuonge vya thamani. Ama, niwe fundo kuigiza kakanumba, masanja joti, usiwe mbali nami. My darling, I need you now. Uwe na mi, haki ya Mungu na kupenda. Nobody can show you love. Usiwamini, ukisha wapa wanakwenda. O basi jilegeze, nikubebe mbongoni. Deka nikudekeze, nikutunze kama moni. Wakija wapoteze, ifanye kama uwaoni. Kisha uniongeze, ulivofunza unyagoni. Oh baby, asa dansi ni kone. Wabami jo, ululu femi. Oh baby, asa cheza ni kone. Wabami jo, basi cheza na mimi. Sajalewa kependa chunga machini kwenye ufungu pareniwa kumbate paritini kwenye tundo kama njiwa uyu wangu mio makuti usini jena kibiriti asawe penzi likage ukachuki nyumba ikawa kibiti asawe nipatie vya kitandani nipe paka kwenye kiti asawe ile sininge shetani nawe kaja kukuchiti. Oba sijilegeze, nikubebe mgongoni. Kitandani nikoleze, kwa viuno ya kingoni. Kisha nibembeleze, nirudishe utotoni. Weka mate niteleze, kama nyoka pangoni. Oh baby, asete sikitoko. Oh banwecho. Chura na ingali umesimama. Ainama, ainama. Asa onyeshe. Ainama, ainama. Unacheza. Ainama, ainama. Unataka maji ya kisima na mwoga kututamba. Ainama, ainama. Enu onyeshe. Ainama, ainama. Unachotaja. Ainama, ainama. Unataka kupiga deki wima umesimama. Ainama, ainama. Hebu tuonyeshe. Ainama, ainama. Unapigaje. Ainama, ainama. Si unataka vya puru tebo sambona una bana ebu tonyeshe unalengaje oya wanangu wa kigogo ni pesa moze yobo funja funja kidogo aniongeze mikongo
gospel on the beat you ready now.
Say it's simple, girl. Why are we so nice, yeah?
Miami lady.
Gospel on the beat, yeah. I got the look, I got the sauce. I got the money and I got the swag. I got the look, baby, wine to the groove.
And if you give me love, then I give it to you.
I got the look, I got the sauce. I got the money and I got the swag. I got the look, baby, wine to the groove. So baby girl, wine ta-ta-ta, drop ta-ta-ta. Pull up in the club and why I wish. If you give me love, I'll give it to you. If you give me love, I... So baby, wine ta-ta-ta, drop ta-ta-ta. Pull up in the club and why I wish. If you give me love, I'ma give it to you. I love my life, oh. Nobody can change my feeling. I love my girl, ooh.
Enough men there with them blue. Your sand drinks are
ready to work with crazy Yangova. Somebody please hold me, because we want to release the beast on me. Somebody please hold me, because we want to release the beast on me. Yeah, I go spend my dough, if you whine it for me. I go spend my dough, so baby whine it for me.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As the trade war between the world's two largest economies, United States and China, intensifies, there are clear signs that China is using its best efforts to protect itself. As a result of its unique political arrangements, the political class of China is stable and predictable, and it can therefore afford to play the long game in this evolving trade war. On the other hand, the United States runs the risk of engaging in a trade war on many fronts between the United States and Mexico, United States and Canada, and between and United States and the European Union. This is one reason why one wonders why at this stage China is the country that proclaims support for globalization and rule-based trade organization, issues which were once promoted by the United States. China has been trying over the years to see what it could do, and one of the plans it had was the so-called Belt and Road Project, which has tried to unify countries in Asia, and even going as far as the Middle East. China has also been engaged in Africa in promoting a great deal of infrastructural development, particularly in East Africa, in having rail and seaport developments and high-speed railways. Last Thursday, China took a giant step in cooperation with the government of Djibouti, which is located in a strategic position in the Horn of Africa. A free trade zone was inaugurated by the president of Djibouti. This free trade zone, about 50 square kilometers, will be involved with manufacturing and services, and will serve many of the countries in East and Central Africa. And the importance of this project was underlined with the presence of the presidents of many East African countries and the chairperson of the African Union. What China is trying to do is to make sure that in the global war, trade war, it could rely on the continent of Africa, where it knows there are strategic minerals and resources that are essential in the modern world. Of course, there are critics who are warning Africans to beware of neocolonialism of China. But there are no signs that African countries are worried about this because, based on the experience of Western colonialism, they have not yet seen such sign from China. And it is also necessary to point out that China has been a friend of Africa. And in a global trade war, Africans want to be sure that their interests are protected. And this may explain why China seems to be welcome today in Africa. But a global trade war will not be in the interest of Africa. And we all have to hope and pray that governments put on their thinking caps and try to prevent such a calamity on the world community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the words of the elders do not lock all the doors. They leave the right door open. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to open markets and increase business opportunities for entrepreneurs in both the United States and Africa, U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Gilbert Kaplan launched a fact-finding mission in June with members of the President's Advisory Council on Doing Business in Africa in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Chaired by the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, the Council advises the President on ways to strengthen commercial engagement between the United States and Africa. Undersecretary Kaplan led a group of representatives from 14 Advisory Council member firms, as well as officials from 11 U.S. government agencies, on a four-nation visit that also included Kenya, Cote d'Ivoire, and Ghana. The trip served as a fact-finding tour for the Advisory Council. The members gathered country-specific information in preparation to making recommendations to President Donald Trump regarding the best way to spur the development of capital markets, transparent and value-based procurement processes, and workforce development. The delegation met with Ethiopian government officials, leaders of state-owned enterprises, and representatives of American and Ethiopian private companies to explore opportunities for increased cooperation. The United States seeks to strengthen economic ties with Ethiopia and remains focused on supporting efforts to create a conducive environment for private sector growth that will lead to broad-based economic prosperity and increased opportunities for both our countries. The United States government and senior U.S. business leaders are serious about enhancing commercial engagement with Ethiopia. As the fastest-growing and fifth-largest economy in sub-Saharan Africa, Ethiopia can become a significant economic and trade partner for the United States, said Undersecretary Kaplan. This visit will help all of us to better understand this dynamic and developing economic market and provide insight on how our great nation can support and participate in the great processes that are happening here.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.